You're listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1996 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother John Launchbury on the subject, Living Proverbs. This class is titled, Discipline.
Discipline in the book of Proverbs. This is relevant for all of us, I think. If we look at chapter 1 of Proverbs, it introduces us in chapter 1 to the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for attaining wisdom and discipline. It's right up there, right at the front, one of the things that the book of Proverbs is about. Now, I gave this talk about a month ago at Shawnigan Lake, and one of the older sisters came up to me afterwards, and she said, well, when I heard you start talking about discipline, I thought, oh, great, you know, this is completely irrelevant for me. And then she said, but actually, I learned a lot from it, so let me encourage you. If you're thinking, oh, well, you know, I've not got any kids and it's irrelevant, there are relevant parts for all of us as we come through today's talk. For attaining wisdom and discipline. If you think about it, these two things go together. They support one another. Without discipline, it's hard to gain wisdom. Without wisdom, it's hard to bring discipline on ourselves or on others. What I'd like to start with in the talk is the issue of disciplining children. We're very familiar with this as a theme in Proverbs, but I'd like nonetheless to explore some of the things that the Lord has recorded to be written here. We'll start with Proverbs chapter 22. We have to ask ourselves the question, why do we need to discipline children? Well, the wise man tells us, verse 15 of Proverbs 22, folly is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of discipline will drive it far from him. One of the things about being a child is that you haven't yet learned about consequences. The immediate is too important. The long-term consequences, that they're so far away. We consider it something obvious that if we know that we do A, then eventually B will happen. How do we know that B will happen from A? Because of our experience. Now put ourselves in the position of a child without that experience. Why should we expect them to know? All right, we tell them, but they only have our word for it. And so there are times in which discipline is something that is able to bring consequences or able to introduce consequences, immediate consequences, to a child. Otherwise, the child does not have wisdom. The child does not have this understanding of consequences that follow actions. And I think this is the root of what's going on here when it's written that folly is bound up in the heart of a child. It's not that children are idiots. It's that they haven't learned the reality of cause and effect. Verse 6. Train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. What this proverb is saying to us is that it's important to start our children in the right direction, to set a path for them. Now, we might be tempted to ask ourselves, are we qualified? Is it for us to say to our children, you have to go this way, or here is the right way for you to work? Shouldn't we just leave it for our children to choose? Shouldn't we give them a free choice? Here the proverb is saying, train a child. It's almost like training a plant, where you, as that plant is growing, you train it around an arbor or whatever. Do we have the right to train our children? Well, when we start to think, are we qualified? Do we have the right? Another question we should ask is anybody out there qualified? Does anybody out there have the right? You see, if we give up the right to train our children, somebody else will take that right upon themselves, and they will train our child. And what makes them more qualified than us? As Brother Tony has been stressing again and again and again, we are a privileged people. We've been born again. We have the very words of God which have been working on us, some of us here, 20, 30, 40, 50 years perhaps. well, shouldn't I just leave my child alone so that my child gets the opportunity to choose the direction? Why should I bring my child to Sunday school, for example, and train my child in the things of the Lord? Isn't it much better just to give them a free choice? Well, brothers and sisters, the world is already putting its case to your child very, very strongly. By teaching your child the things of God, you are giving your child a choice. But if you omit that, if you choose not to teach your child, then you are removing choice from your child. It's not that you're constraining your child by teaching them about the things of God, by doing the daily readings, by bringing them to Sunday school. You're not constraining your child, you're broadening the possibilities before your child. You're really giving them the option, do you want to enjoy this world, or do you want to enjoy a relationship with Lord Jesus Christ? And now they have a choice. Proverbs 19 and verse 18. Discipline your son, for in that there is hope. Do not be a willing party to his death. You might notice that the next verse is the one that we've already quoted. The hot-tempered man must pay the penalty. If you rescue him, you'll have to do it again. And we noted the analogy with helicopter parents. So verse 18, discipline your son, for in that there is hope. Do not be a willing party to his death. This proverb, apparently at face value, is saying lack of discipline, absence of discipline, leads to death. Now, under the law of Moses, there was a sense in which that was very true. Deuteronomy chapter 21 and verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother and will not listen to them when they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of his town. They shall say to the elders, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a profligate and a drunkard." Then all the men of his town shall stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you. It's kind of shocking to us to read words like this. But this is how seriously the Lord knew, this is how seriously the Lord viewed the issue of discipline, the issue of respect of parents. So one aspect in which lack of discipline may have led to death is the literal aspect under the law of Moses. But even for us today, there's a serious aspect in which this is true. There's the spiritual aspect. A lack of discipline, the forces of the world are so strong, if you don't provide the discipline to give your child an option, you're now being a willing party to his spiritual death or her spiritual death. But it's not only in spiritual matters. There may even be aspects of the way that your child lives its life. I think it's true that the USA has almost got a whole generation of undisciplined people growing up. And you see that now in the schools. Not in the children, but in the parents of those children, who now demand that the teachers cannot discipline their children. And so this is an ongoing process. It now is leading to the next generation. And you look around and you see the failed marriages. And you see the broken lives. I heard a statistic recently, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's what I heard, is that the average length of marriage in the US is 2 years. And that's astonishing. And where does that come from? And I think ultimately it comes from people not being prepared, in a sense, to discipline themselves. Well, this marriage isn't working. I think I'll just throw my hands up and give up on it. There's not the discipline, there's not the commitment to push through. I have made a promise here. I'm going to push through and make this thing work. There's another aspect, chapter 5 and verse 12 of Proverbs. This is the context of the adulterer. Verse 12. You will say, "How I hated discipline." This is at the end, verse 11 then, for connection. "At the end of your life you will groan, when your flesh and body are spent. You will say, 'How I hated discipline, how my heart spurned correction. I would not obey my teachers or listen to my instructors. I have come to the brink of utter ruin in the midst of the whole assembly. A lack of discipline of your child means that, according to the Proverbs, you're a willing party to his death. So let's ask the question, how should we discipline children? With what mechanism should we discipline children? Well, we've already seen one key word, and that's the word train. Training is discipline. And as I say, when you train a plant, you are constraining or guiding that plant to grow in a particular way. Proverbs is all about having the teaching present for your child to pick up on it. It's there for us to pick up on it as we read it, and we should be echoing this to our children. We should be a role model for our children. We should be worthy of advice so that when our children need help, they know they can come to us. These are some of the key issues of discipline. But there are others. Chapter 13, verse 24. This is well known, very well known. He who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is careful to discipline him. Well, you may say, I understand that. That's perhaps metaphorical. Talking about discipline using the picture of a rod, perhaps so. Perhaps one could argue that this particular proverb is intended to be metaphorical and is not intended to be literal. But I think if we look at chapter 23, we find something much more explicit, one that we couldn't say was just metaphorical. 23 and verse 13. Do not withhold discipline from a child. If you punish him with the rod, he will not die. Punish him with the rod and save his soul from death. Very explicit, very clear. One question we might ask ourselves is, well, this comes from a previous age. Is it too barbaric for today? And this is leaving aside political questions. There are parts of Europe, for example, where it's now illegal to strike a child. We might ask ourselves, is physical punishment in this way too barbaric for today? I believe that the answer is it depends tremendously on how the punishment is administered, who it is that administers it, why it's administered. We have to make sure that we have appropriate answers to each of those questions, but once we have, I believe that physical punishment still has a place in the discipline of our children. I'd like to make one point very clear, though, at the start. You cannot, and I repeat, you cannot obtain respect by inflicting physical punishment. Respect has to come first. The child has to respect the one who is punishing. Otherwise, the punishment is not doing what it's supposed to be doing. You cannot gain respect by beating someone. It's only when you have a position of respect that you can use physical punishment. The respect must be built in other ways, through love, through nurturing. Secondly, I believe that smacking must not be done in the heat of anger. It's not to be a reflection of how you feel, or of the ire that's rising within you, or of the heat of your emotions. Because if it's all right for you to do that, then why isn't it all right for your child to do that to a smaller child? Your discipline of your child comes from a careful and measured consideration that this act of inflicting limited pain is the best way to constrain your child for the immediate act. You ought to hate doing it. It's the old phrase that when my mother used to say to me, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you. And I never used to believe it. But brothers and sisters, it should be true. You should hate doing it so much that you would desperately find some other way of doing it. But it should be your commitment to the discipline of your child that leads you to do it. Third, love must never be withdrawn. That's a discipline that you must never bring upon your child. Think of our Heavenly Father who loves us and reaches out to us. And however he disciplines us, and we'll come to that more in a while, however he disciplines us, he never withdraws his love from us. And so it must be with our children. And when I was a young teenager, and I saw an older brother disciplining one of his young children, I was so impressed by it that it's a practice that I've carried on doing. And what he did was, the child came over to him to receive a smack, and he received the smack, and then the father hugged him. Love must never be withdrawn from our children. So there are three principles. You cannot obtain respect by punishment. It must not be done in the heat of anger, and love must never be withdrawn. And so long as these are in place, then I do honestly believe that physical punishment has a role. In fact, I believe that it's kinder than many of the alternatives that I've seen used. I've seen parents who are trying to avoid, or completely avoiding this for ideological purposes, trying to reason with a rebellious child, and ending up with such circumlocutions that the child has no idea what's going on. It's not immediate in the same sense. Whereas a sharp smack can be tremendously expressive. I also need to say here that I've spoken a lot about the need for physical punishment because I believe it's something that our society is confused about. But we must also look at other forms of discipline. The disciples. What were they? Disciple means under discipline. But Jesus never took one of them over his knee and administered. He had other ways to discipline because other ways were appropriate. So just as it's, I think, limiting us to say that we may never use physical punishment, it's equally limiting to say that's the only thing in our repertoire. And there are many other forms of discipline which are appropriate. And I mentioned the Love and Logic book, and that's very strong on allowing your child to face the consequences of what they've done, natural consequences of choice. And if you've not come across that book, once again, I recommend it. Tremendously good way of disciplining your children. So we must also explore other forms of discipline, but there are times when the sharp smack is appropriate. So from the parents' point of view, let's just look at a couple of proverbs which address why we should discipline. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 1. The first of these collected proverbs of Solomon. And as you glance at this proverb, ask yourself as a parent, do you want joy or do you want grief? This proverb is very, very simple, very straightforward. A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son, grief to his mother. I don't think it's saying that on the one hand the father enjoys it and on the other hand the mother is grieved. I think here we have a sort of parallel, and it's talking about parents for both of them. Chapter 29, verse 17. Discipline your son, and he will give you peace. He will bring delight to your soul. We have to ask ourselves, do we believe the inspired words of Scripture? And if we do, the guidance here is clear. We have to take responsibility for disciplining our children. We cannot just leave them to grow up as they will and not take into account any discipline. But I'd like us to put a little perspective from the other direction, and this comes from Genesis 47, a little perspective on the way in which we discipline our children. See, one of the things that happens to children is they grow up, and then they'll no longer be children, and one day they'll be adults. We have to ask the question, how will our children feel towards us and our discipline when they're no longer children, when they're adults? And there's a beautiful verse here in Genesis 47, and it's verse 29. When the time drew near for Israel, that is Jacob, of course, drew near for Israel to die, he called for his son Joseph and said to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, put your hand under my thigh and promise that you will show me kindness and faithfulness. Isn't that beautiful? What that means is that when we discipline our children, We should be thinking ahead 20 or 30 years to the time when we turn around and say to them, if I have found favor in your eyes. It's no longer if my child has found favor in my eyes, if my child is doing what I want, but has the way that I've brought up my child been such that I now find favor in my child's eyes. What a powerful, constraining, guiding force on us that will be. So back to Proverbs. From the point of view of the child, why should the child be interested in taking discipline, in receiving discipline upon himself or herself? Proverbs chapter 30 and verse 17. A rather gruesome little proverb. The eye that mocks a father, that scorns obedience to a mother, will be pecked out by the ravens of the valley, will be eaten by the vultures. I don't think it's intended to be taken literally. I don't think he's saying if you are a rebellious child that literally the ravens of the valley will come and eat your eyes and you'll be eaten by vultures. I think it's symbolic of dying alone, of being out there in the wilderness with none to call upon, none to rescue you. But it's a tremendously strong warning to those who are still under the discipline of their father and mother that we need to listen and learn from that discipline. Chapter 15 and verse 5. The fool spurns his father's discipline, but whoever heeds correction shows prudence. Again, whether you accept the discipline of your parents or not marks you out as either being foolish or being prudent. And one final one from chapter 1 and verse 8. Listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. They will be a garland to grace your head and a chain to adorn your neck. This whole thing is expanded two chapters later in chapter 3 and verse 21. Let me read through then to verse 26. My son, preserve sound judgment and discernment. Do not let them out of your sight. They will be life for you, an ornament to grace your neck. Then you will go on your way in safety, and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Have no fear of sudden disaster or of the ruin that overtakes the wicked, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being snared. Here's the idea of the garland that graces your neck when you listen to your father's instruction, when you do not forsake your mother's teaching. So we've talked about discipline of children, but here's the crux. The discipline of children is only the beginning of discipline. Our parents' discipline prepares us to receive God's discipline. The good work begun by my parents has been taken over by God. Many of you have met my parents. And when we came here, lots of people said, oh, I saw your mum and dad last week or a few weeks ago. The good work that they did with me, the times that they had to discipline me, either by spoken word or by making me sit in the corner or by administering physical punishment, that good work. And yes, I can turn round to my father, and if he says to me, if I have found favor in your sight, I can assure him of that. The good work begun by my parents has now been taken over by God. And that's true for all of us. God does take over the discipline. He is our Father. We are born. But we were hearing it before. We are born of the Spirit. And the Father. After all, when we had human fathers who disciplined us, God says, shouldn't I do the same? Colossians chapter 3 and verse 25. This whole passage is about relationships within Christian households. For example, verse 21, fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. Verse 20, children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. But actually, I'd like to go to verse 25. I believe verse 25 should be the start of a new paragraph, which runs through to chapter 4 and verse 1. I think chapter 4 starts in the wrong place. It should start at the next verse. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for his wrong, and there is no favoritism. So masters, provide for your slaves with what is right and fair. Verse 25 is connected to chapter 4 and verse 1. Masters and slaves, masters, recognize what is right and fair to your slaves, because you too have a master in heaven who shows no favoritism. Fathers, parents, when you discipline your child, remember, you have a father in heaven who shows no favoritism. The discipline and the manner with which you discipline your child, you're saying something to God. You're saying, this is how I want you to treat me, Father. And so if you are striking your child out of anger, this is what you're saying to the Father. This is how I want to be treated, Father. If you completely ignore the discipline of your child, this again is what you're saying to your Father in heaven. Lord, I can make it on my own. You don't need to show me which way to go. You don't need to provide me with any guidance, with any discipline. But alternatively, if knowing as we do the need for our child to receive discipline, if we faithfully and prayerfully and humbly administer that discipline, we're saying to our Father in heaven, Lord, I need it as well. And I know that you're a gracious and a loving and a kind God who will discipline me in the way that I need to be disciplined. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you is applicable in this context also. So what of our discipline by God? What sort of discipline will we have? Proverbs, back to Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 11. My son, do not despise the Lord's discipline. Do not resent his rebuke, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, as a father the son he delights in. God disciplines as a father. We're familiar with Hebrews chapter 4, I'm sure, which is the one that I referred to a moment ago. And that verse in Hebrews is essentially saying, if God doesn't discipline us, then we're illegitimate children. In today's plain speak, we're bastards if God does not discipline us. But if we consider ourselves true sons and daughters of our Father in heaven, then not only should we expect discipline, we should even look for it and pray for it. Chapter 15 of Proverbs and verse 10. Destruction will die. The further we move away from the Lord, the harder that discipline will come. And we may hate it and rebel against it and even get out from underneath that discipline. And the end is clear, it leads to death. But the Lord is disciplining us, not because he's angry with us, not because he's acting out of the heat of the moment, but because he loves us. Consider the sheep that got out of the pen. It was now free. It wasn't constrained by the walls of the pen. And it wandered around, and perhaps the wolf ran after it, and it managed to flee away, perhaps. Maybe it fell down into a crevasse. And the discipline that was administered was to bring that sheep back. But think how it was administered. In that case, it was that the farmer went out and he searched and he searched and he searched and he lifted it up and put it across his shoulders and carried it back. Now, sheep have four legs for a purpose. They have four legs because that's how they're supposed to walk. I'm not sure that sheep really enjoy being carted around on someone's back. That might not have been all that comfortable for the sheep. But nonetheless, it shows the love and the willingness of the shepherd to carry that sheep all the way back into the discipline, if you like, of the ecclesia. Verse 32 of the same chapter, chapter 15. He who ignores discipline despises himself, but whoever heeds correction gains understanding. So we have to ask ourselves, do we expect to receive discipline? And if so, what form will it take? Well, I think here we have one of these pairings. We've had lots of pairings in the verses I've gone through, and if you've taken notes of some of the verses, I encourage you, as we've looked at some of the Proverbs, to look at the ones before and after. But this is one that we'll pull out. Verse 31. He who listens to a life-giving rebuke will be at home among the wise. What a surprising joining together of these two concepts. Rebuke and life-giving. And put together this life-giving rebuke. He who listens to a life-giving rebuke will be at home among the wise. Paul has similar sorts of things to say in Thessalonians. So let me just read a couple of verses. This is from 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 12. Now we ask you, brothers, to respect those who work hard among you, who are over you in the Lord, and who admonish you. Hold them in the highest regard in love because of their work. Now we don't have a formal hierarchy in our ecclesias. But there are those amongst us that we look up to and we consider as elders. And they may be brothers and they may be sisters. And sometimes, and it's happened on many occasions to me, and I can think of one sister in particular who would take me aside and would speak sharply but gently to me about things that were going on. And by listening to these sorts of life-giving rebukes, we can then consider ourselves at home among the wise. He who ignores discipline despises himself, but whoever heeds correction gains understanding. There will be things that our brothers and sisters, even those that we might consider less mature than ourselves, there may be things that those brothers and sisters can say to us which will be tremendously powerful for us if we would but listen to them. One form of discipline that the Lord will inflict on us. What about other forms of discipline? Hardships. He may introduce tremendous hardships in our lives. They may be financial hardships. They may even be a loss of a loved one. And that might not only be a father or mother or wife, may even be a child. And these are things that the Lord introduces into our lives as forms of discipline. Now we must remember that discipline is not the same as punishment. Discipline is there to direct, to guide, to refocus. It's not saying, you have done something wrong and so now I'm punishing you for it. The disciples weren't punished in their discipline, but they were disciplined. And the Lord may bring discipline upon us. There may be problems within our ecclesia. And these are not necessarily problems that we can blame on an individual. These may well be problems that the Lord has allowed to come into our ecclesia in order to bring us to a point where we realize that we can't do things in our own strength. That we have to rely on Him to be able to resolve things. And that's very hard for us. I mean, I'm speaking personally here. That's very hard for me to give up control, to realize that the things I want to achieve within ecclesial life, I cannot do. It's not my ecclesia. Moses is a good example of this. There he was in Egypt, wanting to rescue his people. Here he was, a powerful man, had been trained in all the majesty of the Egyptian nation, and he goes to rescue his people, and he sees an Egyptian abusing one of his fellows, and he goes in and he rescues by the power of his own hand. And the next day he realizes that the problem is too great for him to work. And he flees. And the Lord is not able to use that man. So he sends him out into the wilderness. And he sends him there for 40 years. 40 years of discipline. Following the sheep around. Praying. Thinking. Until Moses is transformed into the meekest man on earth. No longer having any confidence in his own strength. Even to the point that God is angry. When God calls him, he has excuse after excuse after excuse. And you can see a chain of about six excuses that Moses brings out. But in Exodus chapter 7, God says, look, Moses, I have empowered you. He says, I have made you like God before Pharaoh. This is the power that I have given to you. And this is the sort of discipline that the Lord brings on us. All the sort of movers and the shakers amongst us. It's not our ecclesia. It's not our community. We have to do what we can, but we are here as instruments of the Lord. And it's in our weakness that God can act. And this message comes through very clearly from the Apostle Paul in The Thorn in the Flesh. I'm convinced, and I'll be happy to discuss it with people afterwards, I'm convinced that the thorn in the flesh was not a physical ailment of Paul. It was the thorn that was in the flesh of the ecclesias. Like in the when the Israelites were told to drive the people out, otherwise they will be thorns in your flesh. And so within the first century ecclesia, there were the thorns in the flesh. And Paul appealed to Christ to remove them. Pull up these weeds, these tares that have been sown in your field. And he says, my grace is sufficient for you. For my power is made perfect in weakness. And Paul says, and so I've learned to rely on the power of the Lord. I rejoice now in my weakness, in insults, in persecutions, and the list goes on. He says, because I can't achieve things in my own strength, now I'm powerful. Because I have to call upon the Lord and get him to do things. Psalm 23. I wonder whether David realized some of these things. You know this psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters, he restores my soul. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. What's the difference between a rod and a staff? It's a difference of purpose. The rod is there to discipline. The staff is there to support. And David is saying, I've received both of these things from you, Lord, and they both give me comfort, because I know you're working with me. I know I'm your child. So, a few concluding remarks. The first thing is that we should not equate discipline with lack of fun. It's possible to be under discipline and yet still to enjoy ourselves and to enjoy our friends and our brothers and sisters. Think of the Pharisees, for example. They condemned Jesus for eating and drinking. They were appalled at his apparent lack of discipline. Now, of course, this is ludicrous. Here was the most disciplined man that the earth had ever seen. So it's possible to enjoy people's company and still be under discipline. Discipline is all about reshaping, remolding within the context that we find ourselves. We read just a few days ago Jeremiah chapter 18, and I'd like us just to glance at one of the things that goes there in the parable of the potter. It's talking about the nation of Israel here, but I think the image, particularly as interpreted by Paul, the image is also appropriate to consider ourselves. And each of us is a lump of clay being worked upon by the fingers and the thumbs of the potter as the wheel goes around. And as he pushes that thumb into the clay to blend it, to mold it into a particular direction, so the clay responds. If the clay had feeling, I'm sure it would not find this particularly comfortable. So I went down, verse 3 of Jeremiah 18, so I went down to the potter's house, and I saw him working at the wheel. But the pot he was shaping from the clay was marred in his hands. So the potter formed it into another pot, shaping it as seemed best to him. Why was it marred in his hands? Was it because he wasn't a very good potter? Surely not. It was because the clay had an unmalleable lump within it. It had a stiff-necked piece within it, that however the potter tried to work around it, it was impossible. And the beautiful shape and design that he had intended for that pot wouldn't work. And eventually the potter realizes that this clay will never be a beautiful pot. And so he turns it into a chamber pot. We, if we're not careful, have parts of our lives that we're unprepared to open up to the hands of the potter. Lord, you can take all of my life except this little bit I want to keep for myself. This little sin that I have that I quite enjoy doing. I don't want you to go in there and affect that part. We, if we're not careful, have our own unmalleable lumps. One of the hardest things is to bring them to the Lord and say, Lord, I know there's that lump there. work on that lump so that you're able to form me into a pot for glory. Come back to Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 17. He who heeds discipline shows the way to life, but whoever ignores correction leads others astray. And I think this is a tremendous lesson to us as well, that by lack of discipline in our own lives, it's not only our condemnation that we're bringing upon ourselves, but it might also be our brothers and sisters. We may also be leading them down the path to foolishness, eventually perhaps even down the path to death. And we see a tremendous example of this in Galatians chapter 2. You'll remember the situation, I'm sure. It's when Peter and Barnabas and the others were up at Antioch, and the Pharisee party came up from the church in Jerusalem and said, "Oh, I see you're fellowshipping Gentiles. They're not even circumcised. You should be withdrawing yourself from them until they take upon themselves the law of Moses." And Peter, because of his fear of this party, stopped fellowshipping the Gentiles. And Paul comments, "So that by his hypocrisy, even Barnabas was led astray." He who heeds discipline shows the way to life, but whoever ignores correction leads others astray. So I'd like to finish with one final one, coming from Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 5. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Slightly enigmatic proverb. But let's connect it with the next verse and take the pair of them together. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. So if your friend wounds you, in a sense, by the thing that they say to you in order to try to help you, to guide you, that's something that can be trusted. That's something that which is better even than hidden love, an open rebuke like that. Something that we can learn from, something that we can grow from. So as I was meditating about this verse, chapter 27, verse 6, wounds from a friend can be trusted, my mind went to the prophet Zechariah, chapter 13. And I wonder, and I leave this as a final thought that I'd be really interested to have your reaction to, I wonder whether our traditional interpretation of this verse is not right. Zechariah chapter 13 and verse 6, the context of this comes from verse 4. On that day every prophet will be ashamed of his prophetic vision. He will not put on a prophet's garment of hair in order to deceive a false prophet, clearly. He will say, "I'm not a prophet, I'm a farmer. The land has been my livelihood since my youth." If someone asks him, "What are these wounds on your body?" he will answer, "The wounds I was given at the house of my friends." We normally think of this as a traitorous act upon this prophet, but perhaps it's not. Perhaps it's the wounds of the friend that can be trusted that turned him from his false prophesying, turned him away from deceiving the people. And someone says, "These marks on your body, did an enemy attack you?" And he says, "No. These are trusted wounds. These are wounds I received in the house of my friends." I guess the question for us is, will we sometimes have the opportunity to rejoice at wounds received in the house of our friends?